Well, this week we are talking about money, and let's start with a mass confession here. If you have ever had any tension at all, ever raised your voice, ever had any hard feelings in your marriage, your past or present marriage, over anything related to money, raise your hand. Yeah. The American Bar Association reports that 89% of couples filing for divorce list money as their number one problem, the number one thing that led to the demise of the marriage, all right? Now, tonight, we're not going to talk about a bunch of money how-tos, you know, practical stuff like that, but what I want to do is I want to spend a few minutes and give you a perspective on money that may be different than the way you've thought about money in the past. There'll be new ways to think about money, maybe to identify some sticking points that have caused you trouble in the past when it comes to money. For those of you that are in Marriage Matters, this will be hopefully some new ways to talk about money in your marriage, in your relationship. For those of you in Rebuilders, you already know that in a divorce, divorce always makes the money situation more difficult. And, you know, regardless of what your situation was, you went from somehow an income that managed both of you to now that same, pretty much same level of income having to, you know, run two households. So the money problems are always present following a divorce. Our hope for you, if you are here in Rebuilders, is that that you wouldn't blame the other person for the challenges that you face with money now. The reality is that you would just deal with your situation, the financial situation the way it is, and the way it's going forward, and to begin to make wise choices from this point on. And that would be true for all of us, whether we're married or divorced, that tonight would be a time to take a look at money and then hopefully begin to make some wiser choices in terms of how we manage money going forward. And then for those of you that, you know, are in Rebuilders and have been divorced, realizing that money will always be an issue in any new relationships, probably even more so than your first marriage. So let's start by talking about kind of a big picture, what money is and what it isn't. You know, there's that verse on the top of your, that familiar verse on the top of your handout. It says, "For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil." So often that gets quoted as, "Money is the root of all evil." But that's not what the verse says, okay? So letter A, money is not the root of all evil. What's the root of all evil? The love of money. The love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. In other words, love of money and how we view money gets us into all kinds of trouble. Money itself is neither good nor bad. And when we look at God's perspective on money, it takes us back to our discussion in week two when we looked at the fall and life before the fall, and work was a part of who God made us to be. We were designed for work. Money then becomes the standard of exchange of exchanging my work for somebody else's work. And if you think back, you know, centuries and centuries ago, before there was money, humans existed in just kind of a barter system. You know, I had a trade, whatever I did, I traded my work for your work. And so let's say I raised dairy cows and I had milk to barter with, and you raised chickens and somebody else raised, you know, does roof work, and one day I need a new roof for my house, and so I talk to you, the roofer, and say, "I'd like to have you roof my house. What will that cost me?" And, you know, it worked out to about, you know, 1,500 gallons of milk. Well, he doesn't need that much milk. And he goes, "Yeah, but what I really need is I need chickens." And so I have to go talk to my neighbor who raises chickens and said, "Can I trade you some milk for some chickens so I can give some of the chickens to the guy to do my roof?" And you can just see how that gets complicated. And so money became a way to represent our work so that we could basically trade our work for all the other things that we need in life, as opposed to just a direct barter, but that money would represent that work. And so that's, you know, God's design of a community working together is everybody doing what they were created to do, and then somehow us managing off of all that, okay? Now, if you look at the Bible, God never suggests that the fair thing would be for us to all have the same amount of money. God never suggests that we should all have the same amount of money, that we should work the way we're capable and able to work the best that we can. We get paid for that work, and then everybody, the Bible says, is that everybody should use what money we have and use it wisely, and use it to take care of ourselves, but also to help others and to benefit others, all right? That whole, God's whole view of money got messed up in the fall, and we talked about that in week two. And so we went from working because we were created to work, and then money somehow representing our work so that we could actually barter our work for the other things that we need in life. And suddenly, work became a means to an end. And in other words, we work in order to get money. And we began to see money as the goal, not work being the goal. And in fact, you know, if you watch people that win the lottery, what's the first thing that most people that win the lottery say? They're going to quit their job. In fact, you know, most people, it's interesting, if you survey most people say that they wouldn't work if they didn't have to. Okay? And even that phrase, you know, I wouldn't work if I didn't have to. And have to is always around money. I work because I need money to survive, but if somehow I didn't need the money, if I had enough money, then I wouldn't work. And that's, you know, that's just not the way God designed it. God designed us to work, and then money represents that, okay? So now, that's God's perspective on money. Let's look at our perspective on money. Most people believe that the solution to money problems would be letter A, or number one, me making more money. Number two, my spouse making more money. A second or third income in our house, and maybe you've had that conversation. Well, maybe you need to get another job. Maybe we need additional income around here. Or number four, winning the lottery, of course. It's always the, you know, everybody's dream solution. And that's why people play, because if you don't play, you can't win. And so which of these four kind of solutions have you at least fantasized about, thought about, maybe even talked about in your marriage, in your house, about what we can do to solve and to alleviate some of our money problems, all right? Larry Burkett once said this wise phrase. He says, money problems are never a function of income. Money problems are never a function of income. The one exception to that would be if somebody is unemployed or underemployed, whether that's for, you know, a reason or a time being. And in that case, if somebody's unemployed or underemployed, that's a work problem. That's not an income problem, okay? But Larry Burkett says that was a founder of Christian Financial Concepts, money problems are never a function of income. And so he said, if you have money struggles in your marriage and the discussion is ever about income, you're already off track. In fact, you joke about the lottery, but if you look at the statistics on people that have won the lottery, 80% of lottery winners in the United States file bankruptcy within 5 years of winning the lottery. Most people that win the lottery within, I think, 3 years are back at or below the standard of living they were before they won the lottery, okay? And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, well, they're idiots. You know, let me win. I'll show you how to responsibly win the lottery, kind of a thing. Okay, we all would love that. But most people, and the problem is because they thought that that income, that money, would solve their money problems, but it didn't. Okay, money problems are never a function of income. Money problems are caused by what we do with what we have. In other words, resource allocation. And so, what I want to do is spend a few minutes talking about resource allocation, how we take the money that we have and how we use it, and how that benefits us or gets us into trouble, all right? And I'm going to, this is just kind of in my brain the way I think about this. I think about it in terms of buckets, and so you can see on your handout, I've just kind of drawn four buckets. This has been really, really helpful for me in the way I look at it. So I just kind of want to walk you through this. In the big bucket is lifetime earnings, okay? And what that means is that in your lifetime, from the time you earn your first dollar, whether that's, you know, mowing somebody's lawn or babysitting or whatever that is, from the time you earn your first dollar to the time you earn your very last dollar before you die, there is a finite number of dollars you will have to work with in your lifetime. And it's different for every single one of us. And most of us have no idea what that number is. But in your lifetime, you will have a finite number of dollars that will go into this bucket. And that's what you have to work with. Those are the resources that you have and how you allocate them. And when you think about how you allocate them, there's really only three things that you can do with them. You can spend it. You can save it or invest it. Or you can give it away. That's really about it. You can spend it. You can save it, hang on to it, or you can give it away. And you know, if you decide to save and hang on to it and invest it, then eventually you can put some of that into your spend bucket or some more of that into your give bucket. You can then decide what to do with the money that you saved, okay? You can give that away or spend that. Now, that's it. Close in prayer and go home, okay? But this is where most of us get into trouble. Because what we're doing with our money is true. Now, also added to this equation, there's this really nice bank, there's really nice building down the street, brick building, really nice people that work inside, and it's the bank, right? And what the bank says is they're going to be, they like you and they want you to enjoy life, and they say, we will take money and we will put money from our bank directly into your spend account before you even earn it. And that's called credit cards or loans. But they say, but you don't have to wait until it goes into your lifetime earning, until you earn it. You can have money to spend now. Isn't that nice of them? It's so nice of them. The one condition on that, they want their money back. At some point, you're going to have to take them back. And notice that you, when you give the money back to the bank that they let you spend now, you have to give them back more than they gave you. Okay? What that means is, anytime you borrow money, especially consumer money, credit cards and things like that, and we'll get into some of the exceptions in a few minutes, but anytime you borrow money, you will have less lifetime earnings to spend over your lifetime. It's just simple math. You will have less dollars to work with in your lifetime because you've borrowed money, which means in your lifetime, when you look at it as a whole, you will decrease your lifestyle. There's no two ways around it. And the bank would try, and the credit cards company would try and convince you that you can actually increase your lifestyle because you can have that now. You can have that car now. You can have that vacation now. You can have that furniture now. You can do all these things. You can go on, you know, you can go out to eat. You can do all these things that feel like my lifestyle is increasing because I can have the things that I want and I can have them now, which is true, except because you have to pay that back with interest. Over your lifetime, you will have less dollars to spend. And so it's a matter of the timing of resource allocation, all right? Now, on the other side of that coin, the bank also says when you build up some money in your save and invest bucket, you can give it to us and we'll hang on to it for you. And if you let us do that where it earns interest, then we will give that money back to you. And when we give it back to you, we'll give back to you more than you gave us. Which means anytime we save or invest that money, in our lifetime, we will have more money to work with. And so when we put off spending by saving it and investing it, then in our lifetime, we actually increase our lifestyle. We have a greater lifestyle. We have more money to work with over time. All right? Now, I know some of the people are saying, well, yeah, but where does taxes go? Because there's no bucket for taxes. What's really interesting is that at least in this country, we have set up taxes to take the taxes come out before the money actually goes into the lifetime earnings bucket. Okay? So the taxes is something up here. So when we talk about lifetime earnings, we're talking about after-tax disposable income, it's called, that we have to work with. All right? And our tax system is even set up so that if you choose to be wise and put money in and to give money away and sometimes to invest money, that you can actually increase your lifetime earnings because less money will be taken out of your taxes because you're doing that. Okay, so all that goes together. Now, for those of us that are Christ followers in the church, the Bible talks about the perspective that everything that we have is God's, okay, and what we do with it. And what the Bible says is that God wants us to recognize that everything that we have comes from Him, and then to give back to Him a portion of what we have, what comes our way through our earnings, which is in the give bucket. For those of us that are Christ followers, that would be a tithe. The Bible says take 10% and give it to God. And then God says, test me in this and see if I won't, bless you beyond measure when you do that, okay? And then the Bible also talks about saving and being a wise saver. So if you want to put some numbers to that, the kind of what we call a 10-10-80 plan is really kind of a biblical way to honor God and to manage your money, and that is the first 10% goes to God, the next 10% you save for a later time, and then you have 80% of it to figure out what you want to spend money on, all right? So now, let's talk about where we get into trouble with our finances. Well, the big place that we get into trouble is with debt. And so this is just a real simple example of how debt gets into trouble. Let's say that we've got, in that lifetime earnings bucket, let's say that every dollar that came into our lifetime earnings bucket, all the money that we earned, let's say it was those were all earmarked for things that we needed. Let's say you could somehow figure all that out. This is a real simple thing. But let's say that 5 years from now, we know that there's $100 that's going to come into our lifetime earnings bucket, and that $100 is earmarked for a winter coat. Okay, so we're going to get a new coat in 5 years. Now, but some people say, but I want that coat now. Okay. And so if we wait 5 years, the $100 comes in, we buy a $100 coat. If we want the coat now, we can buy a $61 coat. Because we're going to have to give the rest of that, when that $100 comes back in, we're going to have to pay for the money that we borrowed to buy the $61 coat now. Okay? Or when that $100 comes in, we could save and invest that and save that for a future coat. And if we were able to get by with the coat that we have now, and then for 5 years, and then buy a coat after that, we could take that $100 that comes in and save it for later, and we could buy a $164 coat, okay? So the difference between when you spend your money is the ball game in terms of lifestyle, okay? So buying things on credit and having things kind of the immediate gratification of, but I want it now, is the difference between buying $61 coats and $164 coats, all having the exact same implication on our lifetime earnings, okay? And so when we buy the stuff and what we use credit for is a deal. But I know some people that say, yeah, but I want the $100 coat, but I want that coat now. I don't want to wait 5 years. And so I put it on my credit card. Now, on a credit card coat, you can buy the $100 coat, and you can buy it today and then pay it off over the 5 years that when you're expecting that money in, and you will have paid $228 for that coat. Okay? And so $228 out of a lifetime of earnings for a $100 coat. And so the decision to have this coat and to have it now is a decision to decrease your lifestyle over your lifetime. We just need to be honest about that, okay? When we buy stuff on credit, when we buy stuff because we want it now, we don't want to wait till, later, then we decrease our lifestyle. When we put off buying, even though we could buy it now, but we say, I'm gonna wait and delay gratification, then we actually increase our lifestyle over our lifetime. We have more money to work with from our lifetime earnings bucket, okay? Now, some of you, you drive around town, and it seems like on every corner and every strip mall, there's the payday loan, title loan, advance, all that kind of stuff. Let me tell you what they're doing, and they're preying on people that are struggling so much they need to borrow money at very, very high interest, sometimes just to get by. But I called them one time, and they wouldn't tell me exactly what they charge. I want to know what their interest rate was. But they charge $50. They charge 50%. They charge $50 per $100 that they loan per month. So you go in and you say, well, I put my car title up, or I'm working and I get paid again a week from Saturday, and they, you know, say, okay, well, we'll loan you the money, and then when you get paid a week from Saturday, then we're going to take that money to pay off this loan. And it ends up being 50% for a one-month loan, which sounds like a lot of interest at 50%, but 50% for 1 month annualized is 600% a year interest, just because somebody needs and feels like they need that money now. And sometimes people are in dire straits and they don't know what else to do, where else to turn. But it's the decisions up to that point that got them to a place where they're so desperate that they would have to pay those kind of almost illegal amounts of interest, immoral amounts of interest in my eyes, okay? So the question is all debt bad? Well, no. The smart, there's one kind of smart debt, and it's for appreciating assets, okay? Appreciating assets. And buying a brand new Corvette is not, and just because you appreciate it doesn't mean it's an appreciating asset, okay? Appreciating assets is an asset that gets more valuable over time. Anybody want to guess what a house. For most of us, a house is the only appreciating asset that we'll ever own. For some people, small businesses might be an appreciating asset, but it's a little bit risky. And for some of us, we've lived through the recession and know that that's not a sure thing that houses are appreciating assets. Some of you might still be living in a house that has depreciated enough that it's worth less than what you paid for it. And that's problematic at times. But for most people, over time, a house is an appreciating asset. So when we borrow money on a house, if I buy a $100,000 house and I borrow $70,000 of that for the $100,000 house, and then 10 years from now that house is worth $150,000, well, now I still only owe the money for the $70,000 that's probably been paid off a little bit, but now that $70,000 that I borrowed is for an asset that's now worth $150,000. So that's smart debt, and for most of us, we wouldn't be able to live in a house if it wasn't for that. So that's appreciating. What about car loans, okay? Most of us, experience debt in our homes, in credit cards and cars, and some people feel like, well, houses and cars you have to go into debt for those two things. There's really no two ways around it. Well, let's look at that for a second. Let's take a generic kind of a $25,000 new car, and the challenge is that when you borrow money for a car and you begin paying off the car, the value of the car depreciates, goes down faster than the loan balance. So very quickly, you will owe money, more money in your car than your car is worth, okay? So let's look at this. It's kind of a typical loan model for a new car. You get a five-year loan, a 60-month loan, 6% for a $25,000 car. You're going to pay $483 and some odd cents a month, okay? Over that 5 years, you're going to pay $4,000 in interest. So over that 5 years, you will have spent $29,000 for that $25,000 car. So out of your lifetime earnings bucket, $29,000 will have gone to that car. And that's, what most people experience, okay? After 2 years, look what happens. So let's say after the first 2 years, you've now paid $11,600 on your monthly payments. $2,500 of that was interest, and your loan balance is still $16,000. You still owe about $16,000, which, by the way, is probably more than your car is worth, which means you're, upside down in a car loan, and which, that just happens, and if you keep going the 5 years and pay the thing off, that just, that kind of works itself out that way, but it's risky. Because after 2 years, when you owe $16,000, but maybe your car is only worth $13,000, and let's say you get in an accident, and your car is totaled, even if it's not your fault, the insurance company is going to pay you back the value of the car. So they're going to write you a check for $13,000. But you still owe $16,000. And the people that you borrowed the money from still want their $16,000. So now, suddenly, you've got to come up with $3,000 just even to begin looking at another car, or even if you're not going to have a car anymore, you still have to come up with $3,000. You still owe more than the car was worth. Or maybe, you know, something changes in your finances and you can't make the payments anymore, and you realize, I can't have a car that where I have to pay $483 a month. Well, the problem is, again, you've got an asset that's worth about $13,000, and you've got a loan that you still owe $16,000 on. So even to get out of it at that point, they're going to, you know, if anything, they're going to accept the value of the car when you turn the car back to them, but you still have to pay them the difference. And so either way, you're kind of out that money. Or maybe, you know, you're 2 years into it and suddenly you find out you're pregnant. And you know, the car that you had is not going to be a good car for a baby. And you realize we need to switch to a different kind of a car. But the problem is the value of the car you currently have is less than the car is worth. So there's a lot of ways that can be risky for you. So let's look at a different model for buying a car instead of just, you know, the typical take out a loan. What if you had transportation and you had a car that maybe it wasn't real fancy, but it was paid off. And you could keep driving that car and do the maintenance and stuff on that. But instead of taking the $483, whatever it was, a month towards a car loan, you begin saving that. You start saving that same amount that, you know, you're going to buy the car. I'm going to start saving $485 a month until I have enough to buy the same car that you're driving. Okay? And so I do that. And it will take me at $485 a month earning interest, it will take me 41 months to save up $25,000, which if you do the math, it's a little over 3 years. So it takes you 5 years to pay off a $25,000 car. It takes me a little over 3 years to save up for that same $25,000 car, okay? And so, and to do that, I would have only invested $19,885, okay? So I've bought the $25,000 car for $19,885. Out of my lifetime earnings bucket has come that, $19,000, whereas you spent $29,000 on the exact same car, all right? Now, that I start driving that car the next time I need a car, I keep saving the $485 a month, and in 27 months, I'll have $15,000 saved again towards my next car. The car is worth about $10,000 in trade, so now I take that the $15,000 I saved, the car is worth $10,000, and I put that into my next $25,000 car. So in 27 months, a little over 2 years, I've now saved enough for another new car, and I would have spent $13,000 additional on that. And so the difference between saving for a car versus paying off a car loan is the difference between buying $29,000 cars or $13,000 cars. And it's all just a matter of when you do that, okay? And we've had in Marriage Matters before, you know, a number of some people that have come back and said, I'm going to do that. And I had a guy come up to me one time in the parking lot, and he was so excited because I said, well, you know, what's going on? He goes, today I paid off my truck. He goes, I said, when was the last time you didn't have a car payment? He said, like, never. He was so excited, and he began at that point saving for his next truck or his next car. And so, you know, you're paying $29,000 and getting a brand new car every 5 years. I'm paying $13,000 and I'm getting the exact same brand new car every 2.5 years. And so then the question is, you know, the other part of that is buying new cars. Buying new cars is a very expensive way to drive, okay? New cars appreciate or depreciate, literally, they go down in value probably $1,000 or $2,000 in the first mile that you drive them because it's no longer a new car, okay? And I'm grateful. I know people that love new cars, and I'm grateful for them because they drive all the expensive miles off in the car, and then I buy their car. And so, you know, if that's what you want to do out of your lifetime earnings, that's fine. I'm not saying that you can't do that. If that's a really big deal for you, you love having a new car, and that's where you want to spend your money, that's fine. All I'm saying is that first mile you drive your car, drive it really, really slowly, okay, and enjoy it. because that's a very expensive mile. You know, my wife and I, you know, years ago when we kind of made some financial decisions I'll tell you about in a few minutes, we switched to only buying used cars. I have a car right now that I bought 2 years ago. It's my favorite car I've ever had. I absolutely love it. I bought it. It was 3 years old, and I bought it for one half of what it sold for new, and it was still in like new condition. Okay, so you know, when you start doing this kind of a model, but doing it with used cars, oh my! I mean, what you can do and not put yourself into debt, but to be driving, you know, nice and reasonable and good value cars. Is unbelievable, okay? So debt is the number one stumbling block that all of us have. You know, where else do we get into trouble with finances, with stuff? And so you see in your handout, I've listed several of them there. We won't go through them all. You know, credit cards. Here's what Karen and I do. You know, I'm not saying that credit cards are evil. I have a credit card for three words. Frequent flyer miles. That's why I have a credit card. And it just, for convenience. But what Karen and I started doing early on in our marriage is that we made the decision we only have one credit card. We don't have a bunch of them. We have one credit card. We share the same credit card. And we use it as an extension of our checking account. We never borrow money with the credit card. In other words, if we don't have the money, we don't charge something on it. In fact, what we did in the early days to begin getting that habit is that we would, in our checkbook, when we charged something on our credit card, we would actually write it in our checkbook and subtract it from the balance in our checking account. So if I put $25 in gas on my credit card, in my checkbook I would write gas and I would put credit card and then $25 and take that out of my bank, which means we would write down that we no longer have that money to spend on something else. And so we had to spend it as if it was already in our checking account. It was great because then at the end of the month when we got the credit card bill, there was no like shock value. We already knew what we would spend and we'd already subtracted it out of our bank account. So we would just write the check to the credit card company, but we wouldn't have to subtract anything out of our balance. It was great. And we made the decision early on in our marriage that if we ever got to the point where we could not pay our credit card off at the end of every month, we would cut it up and never use it again. And to this day, we've never had a month where we weren't able to pay it off. Because it's an extension of our checking account. We don't spend money on our credit card if we don't have that money ready to pay the credit card company, okay? Some people get in trouble with, you know, no plan for large expenses. You know, you're on a monthly budget, things going really well, and then all of a sudden Christmas comes up. Like, well, we got to buy presents and all that kind of stuff. Or you know, something you weren't expecting at home, a water heater goes out. Or vacations. Maybe you're budgeting well, but you haven't planned for vacations or trips or things like that. Or your real estate taxes, you know, whatever that is. So just making sure that you think through and have a plan for everything that's going to come up, even, you know, vacations and Christmas, things like that. Loans with family and friends and relatives is problematic because there could be kind of some subtle control and influence. If you've had a loan from your parents and, you know, and things are really, really tight and, you know, you go on a vacation and your parents say things like, so you're going on vacation, but you still owe us some money, huh? And so it just becomes, you know, it can really impact the relationship. So I would not recommend doing loans with family and friends. A bill consolidation loan, you hear a lot about those these days, and that is they will try and tell you that they can help you with some of your debt problems by consolidating. If you have a bunch of different loans out different places, they'll consolidate them. And the great news is their promise is they will make your payments less. And what, be careful, really, really careful, because what they're doing is they're taking all of your loans and putting it into one loan, and then they're extending it out over a longer period of time, okay? So they lower your payment, probably with a much higher interest rate, they're lowering your payment, and so immediately it feels good, because it feels like I'm having to pay less each month. But again, over your lifetime, over the lifetime of that loan, you will spend much, much more paying off that loan than otherwise. And what studies show is that when somebody gets a bill consolidation loan, lowers their monthly payment thinking that that will ease kind of the tension of their finances for a while. It doesn't take very long before they find other things to do and usually other loans for that the difference of what they were paying before they're paying now, and it compounds the problem. It makes it even worse. So be really careful about that. My money, your money, my money, our money. I have a friend who, when they got married, he was working. He was the primary breadwinner of the house. She had a side business that had a little bit of income with it. And one time they were getting ready to buy, you know, they decided they needed a couch for their house. And she wanted to buy a couch. And he said, yeah, that'd be great. And she said, well, can I have the money? And he said, well, just use the money out of your account for this. And she goes, well, that's my money. And he said, well, what do you think the money in my account is? She goes, well, that's our money. And so one of the things that's been really helpful for Karen and I is recognizing that every dollar that comes in our family is our money. In a marriage, you know, we share equally. So it doesn't matter who earns it. It's all our money, and we treat it that way. No tithe or not enough tithe. We talked about the giving thing. You know, for those of us that are Christ followers and wanting, you know, God's help in our finances and wanting to honor God with our help, with his help, you know, if you're not currently giving, not currently tithing, that may be a problem. And sometimes it feels like, well, I mean, money is just so tight right now. I can't do that. I think about my boys who, one of their jobs growing up was they had to take the garbage out every Wednesday night. It was garbage night, so take the garbage out. And so imagine one Wednesday, you know, it comes and I say to my son, hey, don't forget, it's Wednesday night, take the garbage out. And he says, no, I'm not going to take the garbage out. I said, well, that's part of being in this family. I want you to take the garbage out. It's your job, it's Wednesday night. No, I think taking the garbage out is an Old Testament concept, and I'm a New Testament Christian, and so I'm just not going to do that. And so what if, even though he knew what I wanted him to do, and he knew that one of the expectations of being in our family was that responsibility, and I wanted to, and he just flat out refused to do it, but then Friday night comes along, and he wants to go to a movie with some friends and says, hey, Dad, can I have some money to go to the movie with my friends? Do you think that the decision to not do what I wanted him to do on Wednesday might impact the conversation around him having money to go to a movie? Well, of course it would. And a lot of times we find ourselves in the same situation with God. We're not doing the very basic of what God asks us to do with our money. And then when money gets tight, we even, you know, pray, God, would you please help me out financially? You know, do you think that our refusal to do what he wants us to do on the one hand might impact his ability to and his desire to help us in that? So sometimes how we treat our money in terms of honoring God is a stumbling block in terms of our finances, okay? And then you see a list of spending patterns that get you into trouble, and you can look at those on your own, see which ones you kind of relate to. If you want to talk about that in your small group, you can do that and see which ones you're most prone to. So that sounds great, but the question is, what do we do now? And not just in an understanding of our money, but I think if you want to go a different direction and experience financial freedom in your money, it really is a change of mindset. And it's actually countercultural. I remember one time Karen and I were out to eat one time and we were talking about this. And we were early in our marriage and we weren't making much money. And it just seemed like money was always so tight. And we barely were getting by every month. And sometimes we didn't. And it was just really, really hard. And I remember pulling out a napkin and drawing this on the napkin. And then going, you know, Karen, here's what it feels like to me. It feels like, you know, we're not making very much money, but we got this little level of income here. But our spending is like just barely there. And it just feels like we can't get our head above water. And we're always struggling. But here's what I noticed, and she agreed, that it wasn't like we wished we were rich. It wasn't like we didn't like our lifestyle, the little house that we lived in, the cars we drove, the lifestyle that we had. We were perfectly content. We loved our lifestyle, and even though it wasn't much. So we weren't wishing that we had more than we have now. we just wish we had a little bit more income so that we wouldn't feel like we're constantly trying to get our, we'd be perfectly happy to stay with everything that we currently have, but it would be so nice if we just had a little bit more income so we weren't always worrying about money and stressing about money. And I noticed that, you know, and then, you know, over time, you know, that happens. You get a raise, you know, that kind of stuff. But then I noticed, but that never solved, that didn't solve the problem. Because then the next thing I know, then our spending kind of goes up, you know, a little bit more without us even realizing it. And now again, it feels like we can't get our head above water and we're always kind of struggling. It's always tight and money is always conflict for us and really, really stressful. And so at that point, if we just had a little bit more money, you know, that would, if we could just get our income up, then, you know, we don't want to change our lifestyle. It would just be so nice to not have to worry about money. And then, you know, that happens. And the next thing you know, it feels like our spending is kind of adjusted to that, and you know, we just can't get our head above water. And I drew this on the paper and said, maybe this is a problem that never gets solved. Because this is our experience. Maybe what we have to do is intentionally move our spending underneath our income line. Maybe we need to make some changes and intentionally pull our spending back so that it's underneath our income line. And we did that. And we sold our house and moved. We didn't have a very big house or a very expensive house, but we moved into a less expensive house and began fixing that one up. We sold our cars and began buying used cars and less expensive cars. And almost all of our cars, you know, since that day have been used cars. And will probably continue to be the rest of our lives, okay? And we began to notice that when we got our spending down below our income, the stress went away. And it was amazing. And so here's what we've learned. There is no level of income that is comfortable. Because we think, if we could just get an income that's up a little bit, I'm not saying we need to move or do anything else. I just want to feel comfortable. Well, there is no level of income that is comfortable. Okay, comfort only comes when we live at a lower level than our income. And Larry Burkett, you heard me quote him before, once said, one of the problems that most young couples make these days is they buy too big of a house too soon. They buy the dream house that they think they're going to need when they have kids or, you know, all that down the road. And he said that's one of the biggest mistakes that people make financially is buying too much of a house at the time. And he said, it probably is a better pattern to buy, to think of buying a small house, fixing it up, adding what equity you can to it, sell it, move to a little bit bigger house when you can, put some equity into that. Same thing. And he said, by the fourth house, maybe, is when you should be in the kind of house that you want to raise your family in, you know, the dream house, that kind of stuff. And that's been true for us. We've bought houses and fixed up every house that we've been in, and we're currently in our fourth house, and absolutely love it. But I can't tell you the freedom it's been for Karen and I to live at a level that is below our income, so that every month we're not, in every conversation we're not stressing over money, and we don't make a lot of money, but it's not stressful for us. Because of the ways that we've chosen to deal with credit and spending and how we do that, all right? Getting out of debt. Dave Ramsey, you've probably heard of Dave Ramsey, has a thing that he calls the debt snowball, which is a brilliant plan to get, you know, we were talking about debt, if you just feel like I've got all this debt out there, credit card, otherwise all these different loans, medical bills I'm still trying to pay off. He talks about relentlessly working to get out of debt, and he calls it the debt snowball. And basically write down all of your loans that you have, figure out the smallest of the loans, not the one that's the least interest or the most interest, and that some people advocate that, but take the smallest loan because you can pay that one off soonest, and then figure out what you're making the minimum payments on all of your loans, but but come up with something else. Figure out, we can cut back on our expenses here. We can put an extra $100 a month towards it. Or, I'm going to do some little extra work on the side and have a little bit extra income. But whatever you can add it to that smallest loan. And so whatever the minimum payment was, you're paying that plus the $100. And you're still paying the minimum payment on all the other loans. And then pretty soon, that smallest loan is paid off. And then take the money that you were paying on that one, whatever the minimum on that one was, plus the $100 or whatever it is, and then take all that now and add that to the next smallest loan and begin paying that one off. And pretty soon that one will get paid off pretty quickly too. And you just keep doing that, and pretty soon, at some point you're completely out of debt. That all just started with, kind of adding a simple small payment to your smallest loan and then doing that. And you can't imagine the freedom you will feel when you get, completely out of debt. We talk about, you hear people talk about budgeting. Budgeting can be a problem. If you've ever worked for a company or a state agency or something where you have, every year you have the budgeting process you go through. And budgeting in an agency or sometimes in a corporation is really you submitting the things that you want to spend money on the next year and hoping they'll give you that money. That's a dangerous thing, because the reality is most of us approach money in our marriages that way, by going, let's figure out what we want to spend. And that gets us into trouble. What we really need is a spending plan and a resource allocation to say, okay, this is the money that we have to work with. How much do we want to give? How much do we want to save? Now, this is the money that we have to spend. Now, let's figure out how we're going to spend that money so that we can enjoy it, but that it stays within our means and do that. Okay. One of the things that Karen and I did early on in our marriage, when we knew we needed to get a handle on that, we did what's called an envelope budget. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. And what we did is we got some envelopes. And whenever we got paid, we cashed the checks. We got it in all cash, and then we put it in the envelopes. We had decided ahead of time we need to spend this much on our mortgage, and then we need to spend this much on utilities. We need to budget that much for utilities, and so we'd actually put the cash in those envelopes. Clothes and food and groceries. And then we even had envelopes for eating out, which didn't have much money in it, or entertainment, things like that. And we began to put we did a budget all by cash. And it's a great way to get a handle on your money. It also forces you to realize the decision that you're making. So let's say your budget your envelope for that month on clothing is completely empty. You've already spent your entire monthly allocation for clothing. But there's a sweater you really want. Can you buy it? Well, there's no money in the envelope, which means if you're going to buy that sweater, you got to take money out of some other envelope. And now you got a decision to make, which is a great decision, because now you realize there's a cost in the financial decisions that we make. And maybe what you say is, no, I don't want to take that out of somewhere else, so I'll wait till next month, those kinds of things. So an envelope budget was really a great way for us to really get a handle on where our money was going and where we wanted it to go, all right? And so the goal here is financial freedom. And here's how I would define financial freedom. Financial freedom is when you make decisions about your money rather than your money or your debt making your decisions for you. When you're making the decisions, not your money or your debt making the decisions for you. We've had friends who, some good friends of ours when we were younger, when they had their first child, and it was Karen's best friend, and they worked together in the hospital lab, and the question was, are you going to go back to work, after? And her response was really interesting. She said, I wish I could just stay home with my baby. She said, but I can't. I have to work. And as we processed that, because her husband had a good job too, they had made the decision to buy a pretty significant house, the house that they wanted to raise their family in, but the payments for that house, the decision to buy that house, necessitated both of them continuing to work. And so when it came time to make the decision of was she going to stay home with the baby or was she going to go back to work, the decisions that they had already made, made that decision for them. And it was not a pleasant thing for them. They wished that they could. But when you begin to make the decisions about your money, this is what we're going to do, rather than your money making your decisions for you, then that, I think that's financial freedom. And so where do we go from here? I think the best place to end this is the rule of landscaping. You know what the rule of landscaping is? You know when the best time to plant a tree is? 20 years ago. You know when the second best time to plant a tree is? Today. And that's true about our money. Yeah, it would be great if, you know, look back 20 years ago, you could have gotten a handle on all this and the fact that you're struggling now. But the second best time is today to start to go out of here and to begin to view money and to talk about money in our relationships. You know, 90% of marriages that fail list money as the number one thing. And so in our, for the relationship's sake, let's get on the right side of this and begin to talk in healthy ways about our money and not pointing the finger and looking at how we can experience freedom in our money. And so money works for us, not the other way around.